Welcome back to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. I'm your host, Cindy Sheehan. You're listening at CindySheehanSoapbox.com or CommunityProgressiveRadio.org. So anyway, we have a great show today. I have on Marcia Fineland from the Peace and Freedom Party, and we're going to talk about basic guaranteed income and just other social programs that would be way better for us if we lived in a society that actually cared about people. And I'm busy gearing up for Tour to Peace, so it'd be great if you would go to tourtopeace.org and check out what we're doing. So when we come right back, we'll be here with Marcia Fineland.
Marcia Fineland is currently retired from teaching mostly in public schools in California. She taught in a public preschool program in Philadelphia. Her last 17 years of teaching were in Alameda, California, where she taught all grades from preschool through fifth grade. Marcia was active in the Alameda Education Association, the teachers union there, and received a WHO award in 2002 because she had helped organize the Alameda teachers to successfully win a good contract in the previous year. In California, Marcia also taught in Oakland's Child Development Program and on the Hoopa Reservation in Northern California. She directed the Tribal Daycare Center and taught some adult education and in the elementary school. Marcia Fineland has been active in the Peace and Freedom Party since 1988. She has held various offices in the party, including state chair and treasurer. She is currently on the State Executive Committee and co-chair of the Alameda County Organization. Marcia has run for various offices from Berkeley School Board to President of the United States. She's run for Senate here in California four times. I hope they were all four times in California.
Yes,
she got about 250,000 votes in 2004. She was elected to a four-year term on the Berkeley Rent Stabilization Board in 1994. Marcia has a grown-up son, and in her minute spare time, she enjoys bird watching and working on her native plant garden.
Thank you, Cindy. Thank you for having me on the show.
Okay, that's quite a CV you have there, Marcia. And so was it all in California that you ran for Senate? I was right about that?
Yes, it was. Yes. I never really thought about doing electoral politics until I joined the Peace and Freedom Party.
Uh-huh. So, anyway, today we wanted you to come on, and this is being recorded to be played on our show on Monday, but we wanted you to come on because I read an interesting article about a program in Saskatchewan. I looked all over for the article on my computer. I couldn't find it, but I believe it was in the 70s where there was an experimentation with, I think, the province's government and the Canadian central government on giving a basic guaranteed income. And the reason, and they called it MINCOM, I think that was minimum income put together. That MINCOM, though, sounds like a 1984 word. But anyway, the reason I thought of having you on is because I know I'm a member of the Peace and Freedom Party, and I know that the Peace and Freedom Party also advocates for a universal basic guaranteed income. And, you know, most people don't understand what it is. They don't understand why it would benefit us. So I wanted to bring you on to talk about that.
Well, thank you. I do actually have the program. I do actually have the article in front of me since you sent it to me. And you're pretty much correct. It was for a four-year period in the 1970s. And it was in Manitoba, actually, and that's what I'm trying to figure out.
Why do they
keep calling it a Saskatchewan experiment, but it was in Manitoba. Maybe they've done something like that in Saskatchewan, too, although I tried to find that and couldn't. But anyway, it seems like it was jointly funded by the provincial government and the federal government. And then basically what happened later was the federal government of Canada pulled the funding and pretty much didn't even really get a chance to analyze the data. And why it's coming up now is that someone decided to analyze it, and it's very, really interesting. And
there's from what I understand, just thousands of records, and they studied it from every different angle.
And then they put them all in a box and forgot about them. until recently. Somebody, I guess some professor, decided this was worth looking into, and they had pretty much surprising results, although I'm not surprised. So getting back to the Peace and Freedom Party, we've had, when I first joined the Peace and Freedom Party in 1988, and we, in the next few years, we were discussing platform, I remember that I was one of the people that wanted to put guaranteed income into the platform, and so we did. And then it became called universal basic income because apparently, and maybe someone listening will, although I don't know if any, the people who listen are listening to a tape, so they can't call in, but maybe someone can tell us later what the background of this specific universal basic income program is, because we changed the wording to universal basic income from guaranteed income, because that is something that some group was advocating at some point in, mm-hmm. you know, in the last however 20 or 30 years. And I don't care what we call it. I just think that everybody, you know, it's crazy to think that we can have people who are in poverty. We are in the richest country in the world, and we should be able to, you know, we're made to believe that there's scarcity, there really is enough wealth for everybody. And mm-hmm. if we're going to be real human beings, why would we want anyone to not have a decent share of the wealth so that they can survive?
Well, one of my questions is, it's a universal basic income guarantee. Does that mean that, like, every member of society gets it, even if that person's wealthy? Is there some kind of means test for mm-hmm. it?
That's a really good question. And that is something that they're starting, at some point in Canada, they were actually looking at that. I would advocate for it to be universal because then you don't have a bureaucracy and you don't have means testing and you don't have people slipping through the cracks because they have to go through some type of bureaucratic red tape to get what they need. And then on the other end, when people have more than, then you can just tax wealth so that people who come up, you know, who obviously don't need it will be giving it back. I think that would be a lot better way of doing it than means testing people. The way it worked in Canada was they actually only gave it to fill the gap. In other words, the poor people who were below a certain level were brought up to that level. That's the way the I understand that the Manitoba experiment worked. So it was, in a way, means tested. Everybody didn't get it. It was truly to create a kind of a floor that nobody would fall under.
Well, what were some of the things that surprised them but didn't surprise you?
Well, you know, they were expecting that maybe, you know, and this is the kind of a common misconception, if you give everybody money, they won't want to work.
Right.
Well, they found out that the only people who stopped working were new mothers and teenagers.
Mm-hmm.
And who thinks, I mean, most people think new mothers maybe shouldn't work unless there's, like, really good child care, and we don't really have that. And teenagers should be paying attention in school. I used to sometimes go to high schools to talk about the Peace and Freedom Party, and kids would be falling asleep because they'd been at work the night before.
Right.
And that's not what we want.
Well, I'm wondering, because I've traveled all over the world, and especially in Scandinavian countries where, like, new mothers are given at least 18 months, and it's almost their full salary, so they can stay home with their kids. Is that kind of a special case of a basic guaranteed income?
Well, that's a family benefit, and actually that's not unusual all over the world. It's only in any developed country that can afford that. It's really only... we're really one of the few countries that doesn't have decent family leave. And in many places, family leave includes fathers, too.
Right. And so...
and it sure ought to.
Right. My daughter, you know, she has kids and she works. And I believe she got something like 6 weeks at $90 a week.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Who can survive? Mm-hmm. Who can survive on that kind? So, of course, she had to go right back to work. you know, as soon as she was able. And even before 6 weeks, it can survive on $90 a week.
That's right. It's hideous. And now I think there's some kind of law about leave compulsory, that they have to give leave, but I don't think they have to pay you.
Right. No, they don't have to pay you.
So what kind of guarantee is that? This is interesting. I just found it in the article. Guaranteed income programs exist in countries like Brazil, Mexico, France, and even the state of Alaska.
Right. Talk about that program.
Well, I don't really know much about it. I just found it in this article about the Manitoba experiment.
It's
but just
like
to give you an idea about places that have this, it's not even just rich countries.
From what I understand about Alaska, it's almost like a profit-sharing plan with the oil wealth, that every resident gets like a certain percentage of the oil wealth.
Uh-huh.
It makes their life, you know, considerably better. So another thing in the article is that they found that healthcare costs went down. And
that's right.
Of course, Canada has a national health program. So I wonder, like, if they went down commensurate with how much they spent on the program, but probably not. They spent millions on the program.
Well, something like $4 million, which, let's say, during the MINCOM program, the federal and provincial government collectively spent $17 million. Okay, it was initially supposed to have cost only a few million.
Right.
But think about $17 million, which today would be more because
mm-hmm.
of, you know. But still, how much do we spend on one weapon in space or even weapon,
right,
you know? It's really very little. The amount we spend in this country on social programs is really minute compared to the military.
Well, and health benefits and quality of life benefits, in the future, are very hard to quantify, too.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, maybe that 4 years that they were getting the basic guaranteed income made their lives longer, increased their longevity. So that's really hard to tell, though.
Well, if you have more money,
mm-hmm.
you eat better. You might not have to work as much, and that's what some people did. They just worked less, or they had—they were able to pick and wait for a better job. So they might have less stress. They might have more time for exercise. And I think stress is really depresses the health of the population.
Oh, but, absolutely.
But I want to talk a little bit about the attitude. I mean, one of our problems is our attitude, and it relates to healthcare in Canada. And I saw a movie called Healthcare the Movie, and it compared people in Oregon to people in Vancouver. I think it might have been the Portland area. I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm.
And they were asking about, you know, what do you think of universal healthcare or of a Canadian-type single-payer system? And in Canada, people said, well, of course we should have health care for everybody. But in this country, people thought, why should I have to pay for health care for someone else? Whereas the people
right.
in Canada were very happy to pay for health care for someone else. And I think it kind of shows how our humanity has become perverted
mm-hmm.
by living under the capitalist system that we live under, which has become more and more rapacious. And so that attitude has kind of pervaded our humanity, the way that we think and the way that
we it trickles down, right? That's the word you're trying to think, that a rapacious greed trickles
right.
down to everybody.
That's right.
You know?
That's right. That's right. It's the dominant ideology.
Yeah.
And that's why people don't want to have something like a universal basic income. They don't want to have general welfare. Whereas actually, in order for our system to work, there needs to be general welfare. You need to have healthy people who can go out and keep the wheels turning.
Mm-hmm.
When we have a sick society, you know, the system's going to fall apart. And it is falling apart. But on the other hand, that's a kind of a contradiction, that in order for our system to continue, it has to generate higher and higher profits and become more and more rapacious. But when it does that, it depresses the conditions under which it can reproduce us, you know, the wheels that keep it going, because mm-hmm. our conditions become more and more depressed. It's necessary for them to depress our conditions, but at the same time, it's not healthy, and it's not going to be able to continue.
Well, they have to give us enough education and enough, crumbs enough off the table to keep
right.
us working.
That's right.
And then they can send all the other jobs, just send them, you know, somewhere else.
Yeah. And that's kind of also, that kind of brings me to my thoughts about looking at the basic income as part of, you know, I'm a socialist, and I know you are a socialist, and the Peace and Freedom Party is a socialist party.
Mm-hmm.
We have socialism in our platform. But I just want people to know that when I talk about things now in a kind of a theoretical way, it's not a Peace and Freedom Party party line. It's just, I'm just developing my thinking on this topic.
Mm-hmm.
So I just want people to know that, because people say, oh, how could you, you know, Peace and Freedom Party didn't say that.
Yeah.
It's okay.
Yeah.
But the universal basic, if we work, our work is not really to accomplish something. People think, you know, we've been led to believe that, you know, you work in a computer factory, that your job is to produce those computers.
Right.
And that you can feel that you produce this product.
Mm-hmm.
But actually you don't. When you go to work, what you're doing is you're just selling yourself for that amount of the day to the person who's producing those computers. You could just as easily be selling yourself for doing something else. Actually, what I was thinking of is alternative energy systems. You could be producing, you know, dirty oil, or you can be producing clean biofuels, but actually you're still just selling yourself to someone else who's going to make the money off of that thing.
Right.
But if you give everybody if we actually had a society in which we had a guaranteed income, we could start to think about not selling our labor power, but by
right.
by using our own labor power together in concert to do the things that we need. And that's what I think is really important about it, that we stop thinking about working in this system as being a good thing. That we want everybody to have, you know, that we want to produce more things and have the wheels keep turning and produce more jobs and have everybody, you know, integrate everybody into this system. Because it's not a good system. It's not a system which leads us to produce good things. It's actually a system which leads us to produce more junk.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to find a way to think about work in a different way. And if we separate working for survival, and we say, well, you don't have to work for survival anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But
you could do, I mean, that's a whole, you know, it opens up a whole vista for people. You know, you could actually spend your time studying or, you know, doing things that make you what, complete person. You can spend your time bird watching or growing native plants, or, you know, and contributing to society in ways that make you feel happy and fulfilled, not drained and used and abused.
That's exactly right. And we need to do that, but we need to do that not as individuals. We need to be able to do that as a society. Because,
well, together and,
okay.
You know, in communities and co-ops
uh-huh.
and things like that. And
right.
that would give us the freedom to do that.
That's right. Exactly. Exactly.
And so yeah. we wouldn't have to be wage slaves.
That's right.
We could actually contribute to society and not have our labor, which is the only thing the working class has to offer capitalism, not have it exploited and abused.
Exactly.
So then this brings up a whole topic of imperialism. You know, capitalism needs, you know, the people who exploit labor and make this, like you said, crappy stuff, they need markets. And how, and you know, how can you saturate a market where you have a working class that's either not working or working for very low wages? So you need to open up new markets. And that's a lot of what imperialism is about.
It is. And I'm trying to figure out how the system is surviving. Because it opens new markets, but it also exploits labor in more places.
Right.
And it takes the jobs, like when there are no jobs here, even crappy jobs, or, you know, when they move the crappy jobs away and there are a lot of people with no money, how do they buy the things that they keep producing? So you're right, they're
right.
Looking for new markets, but the new markets are in places where labor's exploited even more. So I can't figure out. So I guess they have to keep making the products cheaper and cheaper too, and that's why sometimes, you know, people say, oh, if you give people money, there won't be any competition, and competition is what makes things better. But I actually think the competition makes things cheaper, and therefore
yes.
makes things worse.
Right.
We don't
right.
actually get better stuff; we get worse stuff.
And then it's almost like we get put on this Walmart hamster wheel.
Right.
You know, where we can, nothing Walmart sells is made in the United States, but now people can only afford to get a job. I mean, they can only find a job at Walmart, so they can only afford to shop at Walmart. So it's like this hamster wheel that we just keep turning around on, and it's just like, you know, people always say, where's the movements? Why aren't people in the streets? People aren't in the streets because our system is sucking the life out of them, and they
sure.
just are working so hard just to pay rent and buy food.
Well, there are two reasons. It's that, and also I think people buy in, like we said before, people buy into that general ideology,
mm-hmm.
you know, that the system is good for them, that people who aren't working are lazy, that we can't really change anything because people aren't motivated to change things. That there's something wrong with you if you can't make a living.
Right.
You know, that you should just go to church and then you'll be better.
If you work hard, if you toil hard, then, you know, that's a very positive thing. People say, oh, go look at that hard worker. But that hard worker's life is being drained out of him
right.
or her.
Right. But they're led to believe that they're being good and they don't see and that's the dominant, that's what they're told.
They have this Protestant work ethic.
Right.
You know, and already my grandchildren, I share a house with my daughter and her family. They look at their dad and he goes off to work and Gigi stays home and, you know, works, and they are not really getting it. It's like mm-hmm. My grandson's almost 5. What do you do, Gigi? You always say you're working, but you're just in your bedroom, you know? They're already seeing this,
uh-huh.
you know? It's like an indoctrination where they're living in a socialist household, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Still this
mm-hmm.
indoctrination that happens. And they pick up on it from a very early age.
Right. Well, they think of work as working to make money, not as working to be fulfilled or to produce a work of art or to produce a work of, you know, writing or a thought
right.
or a garden. You know?
Or making, you know, working to try and make the world better.
Right.
You know, it's
right.
just a really hard concept for Americans. But then in Venezuela, you know, our comrade just passed away last week. But, you know, they had a lot of social programs that really, I mean, it just immeasurably improved the lives of the poor people. But one of their assistance programs that is almost like a basic guaranteed income is, I believe, every person or every family household got $160 food credit. That's kind of like some
right.
kind of basic guaranteed income, right?
Right. Well, here they want to get rid of food stamps. I mean, and food stamps aren't exactly the same, but any semblance of that they had here. Sure, anything that you give people that allow them to survive. You know, it's either a guaranteed income or a guaranteed way of, you know, if you gave them guaranteed housing, it would be a similar thing, or guaranteed food.
Right. $160 is a little over $5 a day, but from what I understand, people
That's
are
right.
trying to feed themselves on food stamps here, they get like $4 a day.
You have $5 a day per person?
I think that's in Venezuela.
That's
but
pretty
here,
good. I mean,
but here it's also per person, right?
Food stamps. I don't know if everybody's eligible for food stamps.
Well,
you
if
know,
they if their family's
family.
eligible, do they have some kind of well,
they might have more for family,
yeah,
but I don't know.
Right.
I don't know if it goes up per person or just a certain amount for a family as opposed for an as to you know. I'm not sure. It's been a long time since I ever got food stamps.
So let's talk a little bit about the Peace and Freedom Party.
Okay.
The platform is, to me, amazingly comprehensive and brilliant. And so, you know, there's nothing in the platform that I disagree with. It seems like some of it is a lot of, like, this transition phase because
mm-hmm.
we're asking for, you know, living wage and benefits and the right to organize and things like that. But one of the things that I think is especially, you know, wise in the program is the idea of working a 30-hour week for 40 hours pay. Can you
oh,
talk
yeah.
about that a little bit?
Sure. You know, We work people to death, and also there are a lot of unemployed people. So if you shared the work, there would be more jobs for everybody. However, people think, oh, if I have to work less, I won't get as much money, and I need my 40 hours worth of work
mm-hmm.
to have enough money. But if everybody got that income level for less work, they would be able to... you know, they would be able to work less and still have the same amount of money. And then, I mean, people need more leisure time. People need more time
right.
to be with their families. They need more time to experiment with other things they'd like to do. And they need more time to think about, then maybe we would get people who would have time to go to meetings or, you know, think of ways to cooperate and change society. The problem is, of course, it would cut into profits.
Right.
And that's why, you know, people don't want to do it. But in general, if people, just think of it this way, if people had more money and more leisure time, they'd have more time to go out and use their money. So actually
right.
it would keep the economy going better. And it's from
right.
a capitalist point of view, they would be able to sell more stuff to the people who are going out and spending their money. Although eventually we don't really want to look at it that way, but it, as a
mm-hmm.
transition, it would certainly be something, you know. That's the other thing. I think actually capitalism would be better off if people had better wages, had more education, had better health. But it doesn't work for capitalists because they have to keep competing and getting bigger profits. So basically, the system doesn't even know what's good for it. And in a way, we're lucky because that's the way we can get rid of the system and have a better system. So we pose this as something that's highly reasonable,
mm-hmm.
if you really think about it.
Mm-hmm.
And if it can't be achieved, then there's something wrong with a system that can't do this, and we need to change that.
Well, and absolutely. And it's just this whole... quality of life thing. Europeans look at us with pity
mm-hmm.
because, you know, they get 6 weeks vacation and they yeah. actually go on vacation. They go on holiday. They go to places. They travel. They, you know, but then again, our comrades over in Europe, they're struggling against, you know, this U.S. kind of imperialism forcing its way into their society and with austerity and things like that. So even though they have it far better than we do, they're struggling against having all of their benefits and perks taken away from them.
That's right. There's definitely a move towards austerity. That's what the Greeks are, you know, the Greeks aren't buying it. They're trying to impose austerity in Greece, and
mm-hmm.
the Greek working class is not they're not buying that, and that's a good thing.
Yes, exactly. Well, then we see a situation here in the United States where it looks like the Democratic president's going to collaborate with the Republican Congress, the House at least, to diminish Medicare and Social Security benefits. And I think our elders are in a far better place to raise some ruckus if that happens. So I certainly hope that that does happen.
Yeah,
I don't hope that they cut the benefits,
right.
But if they do, I hope there's like some kind of Grey Panther uprising.
Right. There definitely is. There are things brewing around Social Security fairness. California Association for Retired Americans, CARA, is kind of organizing around the potential Social Security and Medicare cuts. They keep saying it's only going to affect people 55 and under, but actually, and so therefore the seniors don't have to get all excited about it.
Mm-hmm.
And people who are 55 and under are too busy working to do anything about it right now, but actually it does affect us. I'm not on Medicare yet, but I have a couple more years. It does affect us because they'll cut the cost of living increases.
Mm-hmm.
And you won't be able to get any health care because doctors won't take the Medicare.
Right. So, and then we see that we have a pretty older movement anyway, because
mm-hmm.
people always go, oh, gosh, look at the anti-war movement. There's a bunch of gray-haired people here. But, like I said, our elders are the ones that are, poised to better, fight these things. But then we look at what happened in France. In France, a few years ago, they raised the retirement age to 62. Oh, my God, 62?
Right.
We're going to have a new retirement age here in the United States pretty soon, and that's going to be the day you die, is the day
right.
that they're going to let you retire. But they raised it to 62, and the young people
that's right.
went out.
That's
you
right.
know, because, yeah.
But they're conscious. They're conscious. They know that, and they also know that they're next because they get a universal education. They get
mm-hmm.
free college education in France. So they know that, if they're lowering the they see austerity. And they know what austerity is, and they know that it'll affect them also. Besides the fact that they want to retire someday.
Right.
They also don't want whatever they have to be cut. We really do need, we do have an aging movement, though, and we really do need there has been a student movement going on in California because of the huge
increases
in
fees for college.
In the fees and the student debt,
mm-hmm.
That ridiculous student debt.
Mm-hmm.
And hopefully, because we really do need the young people.
Yes, there is definitely, there was a lot of, in the Occupy movement, there were a lot of university graduates that didn't have jobs that
mm-hmm.
couldn't pay their student loans back, and
mm-hmm.
A revolutionary socialist government would come into power and forgive all the student loan debt.
Well, actually, the Peace and Freedom Party, one good thing we did this weekend was take a position to abolish student debt,
mm-hmm.
and we'll be putting something on our website about that because it's something really important.
Well, it really is, Marcia, and the Peace and Freedom Party, I think you can just, Google Peace and Freedom. Is it peaceandfreedom.org?
Yes, our website is www.peaceandfreedom, with and spelled out, peaceandfreedom.org.
Well, before we go, I've already kept you a little bit longer than I said that I would, but can you just give our listeners the situation with Prop 14 and trying to register more people.
Oh, yeah.
The anti-democratic, that Prop 14 is definitely anti-democratic.
The wool was pulled over the voters' eyes, basically. Prop 14 was passed by the voters in 2010
mm-hmm.
because they were told it would give them more choices. And unfortunately, people don't think things through. They see the sound bites in the radio ads or the television
right.
ads, and they don't really understand what's going to happen to them. But what Prop 14 did was made the primary a blanket primary. You could vote for anyone in the primary. Now, this does not apply to president, by the way, but all the other partisan offices. Vote for anyone you want in the primary, but only the top two go to the general election.
Mm-hmm.
And what that means is you don't have candidates except from the two dominant parties in the general election.
Right.
Sometimes you have two candidates from one party.
Right.
In some districts.
Uh-huh.
And there's actually someone did a lawsuit in the L.A. area that they didn't have a Democrat to vote for. But our problem is we don't have a Peace and Freedom Party candidate or a Green Party candidate or anybody to the left to vote for, or even a, you know, any of the other parties to vote for in the November election. I got knocked out in the primary, and it doesn't look good for us in 2014 when we have statewide races to get into the November election, but we're going to, you know, try as hard as we can. But basically it creates a situation in which we can't stay on the ballot by getting 2% of the vote. One of the ways we stay on the ballot is getting 2% of the vote in the general election for a statewide office
mm-hmm.
in years that the governor is voted on.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't get 2% if you're not on the ballot.
Right, exactly.
So we have to stay on by registration, and our registration rises and falls, and right now, and the requirement rises and falls, because to stay on the ballot, you have to have 1% of the vote in the gubernatorial race, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And we project that it'll probably be about 100,000 registrants, and currently we have about 60,000. So we know we probably need about 50,000 to stay on or more, because you're always going to lose some registrations even if you're gaining registrations. And so we really need people to register Peace and Freedom Party. But I think the way people need to register Peace and Freedom Party not just to help us, but to help themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Because
that's a good point.
As you were saying, you know, the Democrats and the Republicans are in league to promote more austerity. They're not going to give us the kind of society that we need, and we need an organization for working class people to fight for the things that we need. And the only we think that we're the only party that does that, because we stand for socialism, and socialism would be a system whereby working class people were able to take control and create a society in which we don't have classes anymore, because we're all equal, because we all run the system together, that we don't have a class that runs the system and that the in which the rest of us are wage slaves. So that's why I think people should register Peace and Freedom Party, besides helping us, fighting to have an organization that represents us is what we need to do.
Well, Marcia Feinlin, I think that's a great place to stop. And so thank you, Marcia. Talk to you soon, I hope.
And thank you, Cindy.
Uh-huh.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
That was our show for today. I hope you enjoyed it. I hope you learned something. I hope you were informed and inspired as usual. Well, I'd like to thank my engineer, Don DeBar, and he's also our contact with Community Progressive Radio. I'd like to thank my engineer, Mikey, my guest, Marcia, and you especially for listening and supporting the show. This is Cindy Sheehan. You've been listening to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. Peace out for now.